So we're ending our formal presentations today with an interactive technology demonstration. And I would like to introduce to our stage Dr. Ed Olson, who's an assistant professor at the department, in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the University of Michigan. Go Blue.
All right.
And Ed, in 2010, led his team to win first place at the International Magic Competition, which is Multi-Autonomous Ground Robotic International Challenge. And he is going to share with us his robots and that technology today. Ed?
All right, fantastic. So actually, recent educational studies have shown that the amount of amount of material that you retain decreases inversely the longer you've been sitting down. So I've been sitting down too long. I'd invite you to stand up with me for just a minute and just kind of take a deep breath. And I'm going to scramble up to the top of the stage because I have a bit of an allergy to podiums. All right. Thank you, everybody. So I am absolutely delighted to be here. This has been a fantastic conference so far. I'm going to be talking a little bit about small robots as part of the Magic 2010 competition, all the way to self-driving cars. Who am I? Why am I here? Back in 2007, we've heard a lot about the DARPA Urban Challenge. I was a member of MIT's team back then. Chris actually mentioned that during the DARPA Grand Urban Challenge, there was actually a collision between cars, and he very graciously forgot to point out that that was actually us. So, but actually, you know, it's a beautiful problem domain, very challenging. We actually got an academic paper out of it. We collaborated with Cornell, which was the other car, and we wrote a very, very interesting paper. So if you're interested in finding out about why autonomous cars crash, you'll be able to read about it from both sides. All right, so it's a fantastic problem. And it's great, but you know, the DARPA Urban Challenge was a full autonomy type of system. You take your USB key, you plug it into the machine, and the machine runs off for 6 hours, and then hopefully comes back. What have we been doing more recently? Well, we've been interested in looking at smaller robots. Why smaller robots? Well, in large part because you can do stuff with smaller robots that you would never dare to do with a large robot. So a small robot can break, and nobody gets hurt. And you might have little ones running around, and you don't want them getting run over by robots. And because the danger threshold is lower, the types of stuff that we can do with little robots is pretty exciting. We can really push the envelope in terms of sensing, multi-agent coordination, et cetera. So some questions you might ask: what can robots do by working together? How do we create an effective human-robot team? How do we put the human in the loop? And how do we deal with the new and unexpected? That was supposed to change slides. There we go. So Magic 2010. How many of you have heard of Magic 2010? OK, good. So Magic 2010 was a robotics competition much in the spirit of the DARPA Grand Challenges. It was organized by the Department of Defense and the Defense Science Technology Organization, which is the Australian DARPA. And the idea was you're going to take a team of robots. They're going to work together to explore a pretty large area. In this case, a 500-meter by 500-meter fairgrounds in Adelaide, Australia. And the mission is basically one of a search and rescue mission. There's targets in there that we want to find. The robots need to go in, find them, report back to a human commander what a map of the environment and where all of these objects are. So why would we do this thing? Well, like the other DARPA Grand Challenges, it had a whole lot of prize money involved in it, and that was a good reason to do it. So if you're going to enter one of these competitions, one of the questions you might ask yourself is, how hard is this problem? So we've done teleoperated systems. We've done the DARPA Urban Challenge. And we thought magic might live somewhere in the middle. Because here, after all, we've got a team of robots. They're working together. But there's also two humans sitting back at a ground control station. So if things get hard, we can just throw our hands up in the air, ask the human to fix it, and then move on with our lives. Turns out that's not really what happens. So as you start building a system like this, what you find is that there's a whole lot of new complexity introduced by adding that human into the loop. And a lot of people have been talking about that during the conference. How do we get humans involved in integrated into the autonomy? If you've got a system that's autonomous but has a human available, you need to answer a couple of fundamental questions. How does the system decide when it should ask for help? It has to have that basic introspection capability to decide, yes, this is a worthwhile quandary for me to pester the driver. Another problem is that once you've figured out what question you want to ask, you have to display the amount of state that's necessary to the human user. You have to build a user interface. That's going to take time and effort, and there's lots of challenges in developing effective user interfaces. And the other thing, which is a little trickier, is that this notion that you can just sort of throw over the fence to the human all of the tricky autonomy problems, it doesn't pan out. If you've got 14 robots, or a large number of robots, and there's a few things that they can't do, what you find is that there's always one robot who needs help with something or other. And the human operator gets sick of it in a hurry. What you find is that even in a system where you've got a human available to help, the system needs to be basically completely autonomous, so that otherwise the human operator goes nuts. So we're going to build a fully autonomous system, but allow the human operator to step in and use their greater wisdom and sensing capabilities to help the situation. All right, so there was a talk early on with Henrik about user interfaces and this astonishing factoid about how many hours men 20 years old spend playing video game. Well, we actually were inspired by the game StarCraft in developing our user interfaces. So StarCraft, this is our mock-up interface. It has the same key bindings. It's actually a really good analog for what robots can do right now. Sometimes they can do things completely autonomously. Sometimes a human needs to go in and give them more detailed instructions so that the agents don't do something silly. All right. Well, this was our mock-up. This is what our interface actually ended up looking like. It's not quite as pretty, but it's actually the same idea. You're looking down on the world, and you've got a very good picture of where all your robots are. Now, in this case, this is real data. This is a team of robots, about 12 of them, I think, exploring an area that looks something like this. So the human operator's drawn a rectangle and said, conduct a search and rescue mission in this area, build a map, find all the people, let me know about it. So the robots are spread out automatically. They're consulting with each other to figure out, hey, I'll go to the right, you go to the left. They're collecting information about the environment around them. This information is being sent back to the ground control station, composited into a global map of the world, and the robots, and the human operator gets the information that they wanted. That's what we're about. For a sense of scale, this little guy here is a car, and this whole mission took about 10 or 15 minutes. So pretty good. And like we've seen a lot, I think perception is really, really the key problem. If you're going to make a system work like this, you need a good map. Why do you need a good map? Well, you need a map in order to figure out what you're going to do, right? Whether you're driving an autonomous car or coordinating the actions of 14 robots exploring a large area, you need to have some notion of what the world looks like. You also need a map in order to communicate with the user, because frankly, we don't know a better way of conveying a large amount of spatial information to a user other than a map. But map building is really hard, and so Google's been able to accomplish a whole lot, but they collect maps ahead of time. And I would do that too. In fact, we plan to do the same thing soon. And so Google's collecting this known map, but there are many scenarios, especially with small robots, where you're not going to have that map in advance. I think personally, with a car scale agent, a robot that can drive competently on a road the first time that it's never seen is more likely to be safe than a robot that requires or depends on a prior map. That's my personal feeling. So here we go. We're interested in asking, how can these robots deal with new environments? So here's the natural response. Chris had a great video about why GPS is terrible. So one common thing that we get is, why don't you just use GPS? GPS will tell you where all your robots are, and bingo, you've got a map. So GPS does not always work. GPS does not work indoors, which may not be much of a concern for most of your driverless car projects, hopefully. It does not work in urban canyons, where you've got buildings up on either side, and the robot's driving down, and it can only see a tiny little sliver of sky. And it's also really susceptible to jamming. And if you're looking at military missions, it takes a very low power transmitter to completely screw up GPS for everybody. There's also this exciting story about how Iran captured our RQ-170 drone by spoofing GPS and convincing it to land in an Iranian airfield instead of ours. So, you know, GPS may not be the sort of thing that we want to rely on. And even when GPS is nominally working, it's often not very good. So this map here is actually of the magic competition area. And it looks, you can see all the trajectories of the individual robots, hopefully. For a sense of scale, this is about 250 meters by about 250 meters. This is that southeast corner of the larger map that I showed you before. In this case, these trajectories were estimated by our system. If we'd relied on GPS, we would have ended up with something that looks like that. So GPS is really not a great solution for figuring out where your robots are. So I want to talk a little bit about how our system builds these maps, because I think it's pretty cool. Our robots have these sensor heads on them. This little guy here is a laser rangefinder. It's an awful lot like the Velodyne sensor being demoed out in the exhibition area, except instead of having 32 lasers, it's just got one. And so it's scanning the world like this and basically taking cross-sectional cuts of the world around it. So it produces a 2D cross-section. But if you take this servo, this laser rangefinder, and you put it on a servo which can tilt up and down, you can capture this plane and this plane and this plane and this plane. What you end up with is a 3D point cloud of the environment. Here is an example of a 3D point cloud. You can see our little robot sort of tootling around, and you can see these successive cuts coming in and out of the robot's field of view. Now, what the robot's doing is it's extracting, first of all, where it's safe to drive, looking for dangerous objects, looking for objects of interest, which might be injured people or cars or whatever the mission warrants. And then it's taking that information and transmitting it to other robots and the ground control station. Now, one of the biggest problems we talked about in the last one is communications. So comms are really expensive, and if you have a large team of robots and they're all transmitting dense 3D point clouds, you're not going to have the bandwidth for that. So what our system does instead is it takes this 3D point cloud, extracts from it a 2D floor plan of the environment that it's in. It's basically looking for vertical surfaces. And it transmits just that two-dimensional map to a ground control station. And that's what we're seeing over here. We're seeing real-time results as a team of 14 robots is exploring the environment, transmitting their map tiles back to the central location. Now, what do these map tiles have to do with building a large map? Well, how many of you have taken a panoramic photo? Yeah, so you go click, 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 and then software jiggles them all around and makes a nice big photo. It's exactly the same thing that we're doing. We've got all these hundreds, thousands of individual tiles, and we're sliding them around, trying to figure out how they align with each other in order to make a large composite. So this is a video of the matching process. It's a little bit interesting. In this case, we've got two tiles. You can see the gray, and you can see the green. In this case, the green is sort of previewing the correct alignment between these two tiles. Over on the right, we're searching through the possible alignments of the green points on top of the gray points. Now, the particular algorithm going on here is notable because it's one of the fastest algorithms in existence. It can do 500 alignments between 500 pairs of tiles in a second. And that turns out to be a really key capability if you've got a large team of robots and they're all transmitting these tiles back at the same time. Basically, it's exploring the matches from coarse resolution to fine resolution. But sometimes errors still happen. So let's suppose you're using GPS or you're using this fancy tile matching thing that I've just described. Sometimes you get the wrong answer. Maybe GPS tells you the wrong thing, or we find a match between two tiles and those tiles don't actually have anything to do with each other. You know, for example, you've got an office over here that looks just like the office over here. We might get a match and that's wrong. So what happens to our map if we make mistakes? Well, in this case, this is a very common standard robot benchmark data set called the Intel data set. It's of an office building of a robot driving around inside. And in this case, we've added one error. And what you find is that this putatively straight hallway now has a kink in it. Now, is that going to be the end of the world? Maybe, maybe not. Right? If you're an autonomous car, a small error could mean the difference between you being in the lane that you want to be in and you being in the oncoming lane. Right? So small errors can actually be quite catastrophic. If you continue to make errors, the map gets worse and worse and worse. And this is exactly why it's really useful to build your maps ahead of time. Right? Because you can vet the data, and you can make sure your map makes sense, and so you don't send your car out trying to localize against a world model that looks like this. So this is where some of the exciting work very recently even from the University of Michigan, as well as a number of other universities. Within the last 12 months, there's been an enormous explosion in the sophistication of optimization algorithms. The basic idea is that once you get all these map alignments, the game is to compute the most likely configuration of all of those tiles that gives you the best map. And in the last 12 months, we've gotten hugely better algorithms for dealing with errors. And so here we see the same data sets as we saw before, where the map quickly degrades in quality. But with the sort of the state-of-the-art methods, we're basically immune to this. What does this mean for our cars? Well, I think this is going to be the technological lever that allows us to drive in environments we've never seen before. If we're driving in an environment we've never seen before, we're likely to make mistakes. We can't afford to fail catastrophically. But if we've got an optimization infrastructure that can cope with those mistakes, maybe now we can actually drive in novel environments. That would be very cool. All right, so I've been talking a whole lot. Let's bring out the robots. So we've brought a few of our robots with us. We have we built 24 of these guys. We're going to have three of them with us. All right, we actually have about all kinds of back here, but some of you must be checking your email, and these are using Wi-Fi, so shame on you. All right, that was a joke. Tough crowd. All right. So we built 24 of these robots. We took 14 of them to Australia. We've got a few here. The first thing you're going to notice about the robots is they've got this nodding laser rangefinder. This is the rangefinder that we were talking about a moment before. Another very conspicuous feature of this robot are these sort of 2D barcode things. Any guesses? What are those for? Right, so the robots can recognize each other. They're sort of like QR tags, except these are optimized to be able to be decoded from much longer ranges and to give us much more accurate positioning information when we do detect one. We've got a team of robots. It's really useful if the robots can recognize their buddies. Inside, there's really no magic. These robots have a very standard Intel laptop inside, and which you can't see from where you're sitting, but that's okay. And inside, It's straightforward. We've got a large battery, some industrial controllers, a couple radios. Basically, I'm cracking the lid here just to show you how mundane the interior of the car is, the interior of the vehicle is. Right? All the magic is really happening in software. So I'd like to show you, again, the data that we collected before. This is a little bigger, so now you can see it. One thing that you'll notice from this data is there's sort of two conflicting reactions that we get. One person will say, wow, look how much the robot can see. That's amazing. And in fact, it is kind of amazing. These sensors are amazing. If you look at the Velodyne, the data is awesome. But at the same time, there's a lot of detail that's missing. If we're talking about trying to be able to detect which way someone's face is looking in a car, we're not going to have the resolution to do that. Right? I can do that in a lab with controlled lighting and a high-resolution camera. I can tell you which way your head is facing. But I can't do it with a sensor like this that's 30 meters away from the person who's giving me a furtive glance from the other side of the intersection. So there are real challenges here. I think to both the Google car approach and our approach, another car is basically just a bunch of dots. Right? There's not a whole lot of introspection that we're doing on that point cloud. And that means that there's a lot of data that we're not yet capturing. To bring this, make this a little more real, this is data that we collected last night of the room that you're sitting in. And so you can see, here's the robot, here's the stage that I'm standing on, and this is where all y'all are. And what you can see is that there's enough information here to get a good notion of what the environment looks like, its gross shape, and all that sort of thing. But we're not going to be able to resolve individual people very well, much less figure out which way your head is facing. So there are real challenges in towards making these systems work for cars. So I want to walk you through a mission with these robots. How am I doing for time? Beautiful. All right, so we're going to go on a hypothetical search mission with our robots. In this case, let's suppose we get a call. We need to do a search and rescue mission in this environment. We're going to deploy our robots here. And so one of the notions is that you get the call, you don't need any prior maps, you don't need to harass Google for some aerial imagery, you just show up with your van and you drop the robots off. That's really what we're aiming for. Now, the first thing that happens is the robots have just been turned on. They have no idea where they or their buddies are. But as the robots are recognizing each other using their barcodes, we're able to draw their maps into alignment. And so what you see here is the robots initializing their position with respect to each other, starting off with the very small seed of a brand new map. We then start sending the robots off in different directions to explore as rapidly as possible. It's the world's simplest algorithm. It's, if you haven't seen it yet, send a robot there. All right, this is what where computer science professors get tenure. All right. From the operator's perspective, the operator is sitting around, and they're seeing a display that looks like this. And this is showing them a large amount of information. They can query the system and ask things like, what's the status of robot number 7? Why is it still sitting backstage? So we can get a lot of information from that. And this is basically what the mission looks like for the first few seconds. We had a team of robots go off to the left, go off to the center, and go around. And so the robots, for the most part, are doing their own thing. Right? They're going to places that they have never seen before, and the operator is sitting back and pretending not to look worried. He's doing pretty good, isn't he? All right. Next slide. So there are a few places where humans can really be invaluable online. And one of those is that if a human looks at one of these maps and something bad has happened, the human knows it immediately. We just have an incredible sense for detecting bad maps. In this case, we've intentionally broken the system so that there's a misalignment in the map. And what this interface allows the human operator to do is to click on two robot poses and tell the system, hey, you know, robot 14 and robot 7, whatever robot that is, you guys are actually nearby each other. You guys might want to trade notes and chat with each other. And then they do that, and we're able to pull those maps into alignment. And this is a key step. You'll see that right here. Bam, the map snaps into alignment. Right, we need to keep that map high quality in order to preserve the efficacy of the planning systems and to make the map good. All right. So another thing the human can do, especially in a search and rescue mission, a human's going to have a sort of notion about the environment that robots generally don't have. Ask yourself this question. You're in a building you've never been in before, and you need to use the restroom. You're maybe in a restaurant. You have a pretty good idea where to look, right? You're not going to start walking out the front door to find the restroom, right? It's probably back by the back bar area or something like that. Humans know a huge amount of stuff, and we want to allow humans to feed that knowledge into the system. In this case, the humans suspected that these two robots could close a loop up here, that they'd be able, by driving around these hallways, that those hallways might actually meet up again. Now, the great thing that happens is that when robots meet up, we're able to correct errors in the map. So we're going to see that again. At this point, the human operator is thinking, hey, you know, I bet this hallway and this hallway are eventually going to meet up. So they're manually overriding the automatic task exploration and saying, no, don't explore over there. I want you to go over here, because that's going to be good. Right? We're going to be able to close a loop that way. We do the same thing with this robot. A little time passes. They get close to each other. And then the map snaps into alignment. And the map snaps into alignment. Everybody together. There we go. The map snaps into alignment. All right, so that's fantastic. All right, so the other thing a system like this can do, if you're doing a search and rescue type mission, or you might be looking for interesting objects. So in this case, we've got some scout robots, and they're going around. In this case, hey, they found our car. Well, that's fantastic. A little window pops up to the operator saying, something interesting has happened. Maybe you should put down your coffee and start paying attention. This is actually exactly the same sort of scenario that we'd have in an autonomous car situation, where the car determines that it's no longer safe to operate autonomously. Right? This is, I'm getting the operator's attention. At that point, the system automatically figures out that it should send a rescue robot, or a disruptor in this case, to that object of interest. We're in the wrong part of the film. All right, so the sensor is exploring. It finds the object. That creates a new task in our system, which says, hey, I should send one of the disruptor robots to that object. Now, the disruptor robot leaps into action. It's actually really cool to watch, because all of a sudden, this robot that's been sitting there starts flying off. It takes a direct route to the target using all of the map information that's previously been collected, drives straight to the target, and as we did in the magic competition, we turn on a cat toy laser in order to indicate that we've seen the object. All right, so let's take a look at the whole mapping process as a whole, because for those of you who like mapping, this is fun. And what you're going to notice is that every time robots come together, the map fixes itself, right? These robots might accumulate error as they're driving around a large loop, but the moment robots come back together, we're able to align their tiles and produce a better photo mosaic of the map. And what I didn't mention is that we won the magic competition, which was a lot of fun. All right. I hope you guys have been submitting questions, because that would be fantastic. If you have questions, please get those in. All right, so where are we going with this? So we've done a lot of small robots, and we'll continue to do small robots, but we are really interested in driverless cars, or self-driving cars. I like Chris's word for that. So we want to take these ideas and put them back into autonomous cars. How do we deal with environment changes, or new environments that we've never seen before? I think that some of the technology that's emerging is really going to be essential to being able to allow a robot to reliably build a map the first time it encounters an environment. Right, so you drive it down, and it can drive down an environment the first time it sees it. That's going to be cool. We also need to push towards lower-cost sensors. And this is another aspect of we're going to degrade our sensor quality more by using cameras or radars. This is going to create even more challenges for holding this map together. The worse your data is, the blurrier your camera, the harder it is to make a photo mosaic. We're also interested in the multi-vehicle aspect cooperation. This is very analogous to sort of the search and rescue. We might not be deciding collectively, you go right, I go left, but we might agree on how fast to drive down the road, or that maybe the car with the, maybe these four cars, which can drive faster at a higher fuel efficiency, should stay in the left, and the slower car should go to the right. So trying to get that multi-agent cooperation going is really important. And we're interested in autonomy and active safety as well. So the exciting thing that's happened to us in the last couple months is that through a generous donation from Ford, we now have a Ford Escape hybrid vehicle, so modified by Torque. So we're going to be back in the game and applying these technologies to this car and showing off, hopefully next year, that Google's got someone nipping at their heels. I'll stop here and ask for questions.
Mine was go green. I don't know what that means, but
no.
I didn't really hear anything other than that.
Who was that?
Okay, thank you so much, Ed. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Oh, my students, come on out. So these are the rock stars that are going to make next generation autonomous stuff possible. Let's give them a hand.